Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Do you cut coupons or drive around looking for the gas station with the lowest price? If so, you might think of yourself as a skinflint, but you've probably got nothing on Jeff Yeager, who proudly claims the title, the ultimate cheapskate. Jeff doesn't just stretch a dollar, he gets his cash to do calisthenics. He's author of several books rife with miserly tips, including The Cheapskate Next Door, Don't Throw That Away, and How to Retire the Cheapskate Way. So, Jeff, you own this title, The Ultimate Cheapskate, but you also go by a few others, The Titan of Tightwads or The Commander-in-Chief, and it seems like there's no shortage of puns when it comes to being frugal. Tell me a little bit about what it means to be part of the Cheap Pride movement.
Well, you know, I've been writing about this stuff for almost 10 years now, since before the Great Recession, and I try to bring a sense of humor to this topic of living more frugally. I believe that most Americans, not all Americans, but most Americans would actually be happier and the quality of their life would increase if they would only spend and consume less. So it's not about deprivation or sacrifice. It's certainly not about being dishonest or greedy. It's ultimately about valuing your time and the things you can do with it more than money and the stuff that you can buy with it. Through my writing and so on, I've interviewed hundreds and literally surveyed thousands of fellow cheapskates, and I found that they do tend to be happier. And I'm not talking about, you know, a Scrooge, a miserly person that's just trying to build up a big bank account. I'm talking about people who have said to themselves, you know, I could afford to spend more, but it wouldn't make me any happier.
So your books introduce readers to all sorts of thrifty folks with all sorts of thrifty ways of getting around, including some who even recycle wall calendars, I guess. You know, your 2013 calendar will be good again in, 2019?
Yes, I'm always learning things. And it was, I think, on my last book, I wrote about a gentleman up in Pennsylvania who claimed that he was the ultimate cheapskate, that he had a huge collection of calendars. And I said, Bruce, are you saving these as collector's items? And he looked at me with sort of disdain, and he said, you call yourself a cheapskate. You should know that all calendars eventually become current again. There's websites, if you Google it, that will tell you when this year's calendar will be current again. So there's never a need to really buy new calendars.
Well, it sounds like Bruce has a lot of forethought. You know, do you find that being frugal requires a lot of prep ahead of time?
That's one of the big, I think, myths about folks like me. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about and trying to save money. You know, so we're not these sort of pensive penny pinchers that are running hither and yon trying to find, you know, save a nickel here, save a nickel there. For the most part, the hallmarks of sort of my brand of cheapskate is we don't like to shop. We spend significantly less time shopping than most Americans. We shop smart, but we just don't shop a lot.
So spending is a big part of it, but you also dole out some more substantial advice, home buying issues, for example. You take issue with the concept around starter homes. Why is that?
I ranted about starter homes originally, saying that that terminology dates back to a time when, before we had starter wives and starter husbands. My phrase has always been, finish in your starter home. My advice for home buying is to buy a modest but comfortable home when you're first starting out. Stay there as long as you can, pay it off just as quickly as you can, and get on about enjoying that home and meeting your neighbors and settling in. You know, that's a radical notion. It's as radical as what all of our grandparents did.
Jeff Yeager is the author of four books on getting more out of life by spending less, his latest of which is How to Retire the Cheapskate Way. Another serious topic people have talked about, the sort of million-dollar nest egg concept. You know, a lot of financial gurus say that's what we need for retirement. You may agree or disagree. How much do you think people need?
There's not one definite answer. I rant a lot against what I call the million-dollar mantra, which is retirement planners by and large saying, oh, my Lord, you need at least $1 million to retire. And that doesn't include the value of your home. That may or may not be correct. In many cases, I think that that's hogwash. I think that people can retire happily on less than that. But it all comes back to, Taylor, you guessed it, the spending side of personal finance. If you really crunch the numbers, if you become, as I call it in my retirement book, your own CFO, that would be chief frugal officer, really crunch the numbers of what it costs for you to live, what's important to you in life, you might find that you can retire on significantly less than that, particularly if you're able to get the yoke of debt off your back.
What about some of the cultural issues that come with being a cheapskate? You know, I think one big example, the intersection of being cheap and, you know, some of the typical etiquette issues that we have to deal with on a regular basis.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, again, I'm not talking about condoning anything that's dishonest or unethical or anything like that. Here's a quick example. In my survey of cheapskates, I asked them about their tipping habits. 96% said that they tip at or above industry standards when they go out to eat, for instance. Here's the kicker. They only go out to eat about 25% as much of the time as the average American family does. So their attitude, I think, is a very noble one, which is, you know, if I can't afford to leave a decent tip, then I really can't afford or I don't want to go out to dinner. In all these issues, things like buy one, get one free coupons or asking for separate checks, the important thing is to have the conversation right up front and very directly. Don't wait until the check comes.
You know, the way you describe it, it almost makes being frugal sound sort of like a spiritual, like a Buddhist path. Do you know what I mean? Do you ever think about the spiritual side of frugality?
It's interesting that you ask that because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of philosophical underpinnings to it. And in fact, our nation was really founded on virtues that included thrift and frugality, right, and conservation, right at the top of the list. And now those things have become very uncool. In that survey I mentioned earlier, I asked my cheapskates some questions about their beliefs and if, in fact, they were living on less simply to amass a big bank account. And again, the answer was 90% something no, that in fact it all came back to some higher purpose. Quite a number of them had religious views, which didn't necessarily say that having money was bad, but it certainly taught them that there was more to life than having money.
Well, here's a tough question, Jeff. You know, I think there's a lot of people out there who are very frugal, very responsible with money. They spend less. But, you know, often they might be in relationships or have family relationships with people that don't have those same habits. Now, how do you deal with the people around you who might not share the same values?
Yeah, it can be tough. And again, the golden rule, as I articulated before, is to have those conversations up front. If you have money problems in your family, you know, don't be sheepish about broaching those subjects. I've often noticed that guys like me tend to oftentimes in our family being sort of the butt of everyone's joke, the guy they're kind of giggling about behind their backs. But I'll also say that I've noticed that when people have financial problems, we tend to be the ones that they turn to. I often get asked the question, Jeff, you're a cheapskate. What kinds of things are you giving up? The answer is very simple. Do you know that there was a survey that showed that 80% of the discretionary items that Americans buy, they express some regrets about having purchased within a year of having purchased it. Now, don't get me wrong, they might still do it again. But we know buyer's impulse. I like to think that cheapskates like me are simply trying to figure out what that 80% is going to be before we buy it.
So is there anything that you're not willing to skimp on?
One of my miser advisors, these are people who sign up on my website for free, of course, to give me advice, who I thought had a great answer to that question, which is I would always spring extra for the anesthesiologist for my colonoscopy every 5 years.
Jeff Yeager is the ultimate cheapskate and author of several books on living frugally. He's also a blogger and the star of the AARP online series, The Cheap Life. Jeff, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Stay cheap, Taylor.
Will do. You can find money-saving tips on his website. We posted a link to that and much more on Jeff at wordofmouthradio.org. I can be a bit of a cheapskate myself, especially when it comes to food. If I can't tell the difference between two similar products, the first thing I look at to determine which to buy, not surprisingly, is the price tag. But sometimes being a frugal shopper means more than just picking the right brand. Sometimes it's about getting your hands dirty. Take pistachios, for example. I always buy them with the shells on. Why? Because they're cheaper. Presumably, consumers are paying extra for the privilege of not having to split a thumbnail cracking them open. But when we asked around the office at our Concord studios, it turns out there's lots of reasons people choose to buy whole pistachios.
For some reason, I buy them with the shells, perhaps because of some kind of pseudo-Catholic penance.
Because if I didn't, I would eat too many pistachios too fast, and so I need the shell on to help pace my pistachio intake.
It's more fun.
I love crunching on the shell with my teeth.
Because I'm cheap.
But here's the question. How much money do you actually save shelling your own pistachios? I conducted an entirely unscientific experiment to find out. A 6-ounce bag of shelled, ready-to-eat pistachios from the brand Wonderful costs $5.99 at a Hannaford's in Concord. A foot away on the same shelf, you can find an 8-ounce bag of whole pistachios for $1.50 less. That bag is heavier and cheaper, but just how much of the 8 ounces is composed of useless, inedible shell? After cracking the contents and weighing what was left, it turned out nearly half of the bag's weight went straight to the compost, and only 4.3 ounces of actual pistachio remained. Okay, so I can't see if everybody's pulling out their calculators right now, so I'll just cut to the chase. It turns out that the 8-ounce bag of whole pistachios costs more, to the tune of 9 extra cents per ounce of edible product.
So you pay more to do your own shelling?
Yes.
Really? That's so weird.
What's the math on that?
Really? Wow.
I don't believe you. I actually don't believe you.
I should remind discerning listeners that my experiment was rather unscientific and very limited in scope, and loosely applies only to one brand in one size at one grocery store. But you have to admit, it is a little shocking to discover that under some circumstances anyway, you're shelling out more for the privilege of cracking a nut. A couple weeks ago, the Associated Press reported that the Department of Agriculture was dropping a new vanilla-flavored rabies vaccine by airplane over New Hampshire forests as part of a 5-state pilot study. Okay, if that sounds a little strange to you, get this. Apparently, the government has been distributing rabies vaccines by plane for over 15 years. The story piqued the interest of NHPR environmental reporter Sam Evans-Brown, so he did some digging. He's here to tell us more. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Taylor.
So first of all, Sam, is rabies much of a problem in New Hampshire or in New England in general?
Well, the answer is really no. I mean, rabies kills about 55,000 people worldwide annually, but 95% of them are in Africa. In the United States, it kills about 3 people a year. So rabies is not a problem. However, I think if you were to talk to the officials at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they would tell you that that's largely because of their vaccination efforts, which have kept it from becoming a problem. But I think it's important to realize that you have to know a little bit about the history of rabies to understand why this has become a priority, because it was this disease that came in, and it was a little terrifying. I mean, rabies, if you have rabies, if you're found to actually have it in your bloodstream, it kills you. It's 100% fatal. And so when it was first found in Florida and started to march north in the 50s and then had this big jump up to Virginia in the 70s, it was really frightening. And people were terrified that there was this 100% fatal disease coming to their backyard.
Plus the symptoms, foaming at the mouth, you know, they're sort of scary. I mean, they make people think of, you know, zombies and horror movies.
It is not a pleasant way to go, rabies. So I think there's a lot of fear associated with it, even though it's not not a huge killer or even a moderately large killer in any way.
So give me some details on the program then. What exactly are they dropping? How much? You know, what kind of animals are they trying to attract?
So they're dropping vanilla-flavored rabies oral vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just a little packet, looks like a blister pack pill, smeared with vanilla flavoring, or some of them are fish meal flavored. And they drop them from airplanes, from fixed-wing airplanes over rural areas. And they're dropping a lot of them. I mean, we're talking 75 vaccines per square kilometer. So, I mean,
wow.
They are peppering the forest with these things. And, you know, I talked to one of the organizers of the programs. So he told me that they have dropped 135 million baits since 1997.
Wow.
And so, I mean, it's a massive program. It's going on in 15 states. It's basically a big stripe up the eastern seaboard of the country where they're just trying to hold the disease in place.
Given that so few people have actually had rabies recently, how do they measure the effectiveness of a program like this?
Well, so very few people have had rabies, but animals still get them quite a lot. And so there are a couple measures of the effectiveness here. One is they had a program, an early program in Texas, which literally eradicated canine rabies from the state. There is no canine rabies in the United States anymore because of these type of vaccination efforts. But what they do, and again, this is a massive undertaking. It's totally shocking to me that this amount of work is going on in this. But they, you know, they distribute the vaccines, and then they're going out and they're trapping thousands of animals. The vaccines have a marker in them so that they can actually pull a tooth from an animal and tell if the animal has eaten one of the packets, and then they can test the animal to see if it's vaccinated. So, or if it's immunized, excuse me. So what they found is that with the old vaccine, they were getting about 30% of the population. And this is they trapped 80,000 animals in their study area to test this. So the 30% of that population had developed an immunity. And now this new vaccine that they're rolling out, the one that we picked up on, they're finding 50 to 60% immunization. So it's only getting better.
What about, you know, people who go for walks with their dogs? I mean, if they're dropping this many packets out there, you know, presumably somebody's puppy could be picking those up as they're walking through the woods.
Right. And they stress that if you find one, please just put it into the woods somewhere that some wildlife might find it, because they're $1.23 a packet. I mean, they aren't cheap. And so the in order to maximize the effectiveness, they'd prefer not to immunize a dog who probably is already immunized from their typical shots. But if your dog eats them, it's safe as long as they don't eat too many, in which they say the dog might get an upset stomach, which is what happens if a dog eats too much of anything.
Right. That's a good point. You just mentioned they cost, what did you say, $123 per packet. Is there any way to know whether or not this program has been a cost-effective one?
So they have undergone an economic study of the cost of this program versus the cost of if rabies were to spread throughout the United States. And, you know, they basically modeled it. They said that rabies tends to move at about 70 miles a year if you don't have some sort of buffer like the one that they're creating, stopping it from moving. And as rabies moves, you have to understand that in areas where there is rabies, you have cattle that have to be immunized. Pets have to be immunized. You have sort of prophylactic immunization if you get bit by an animal, and that's very expensive. Their economist says that it is more cost-effective than just letting rabies spread throughout the United States.
Sam Evans-Brown is NHPR's environment and education reporter. Sam, thank you so much for telling us about the story.
Any old time.
And there's more word of mouth coming up after a break. Stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. If recent revelations about the NSA's domestic surveillance programs have you worried about the future of American privacy, it might do you good to think back to when you were still in high school and nearly all of your activities were monitored by another powerful domestic agency, your parents. Since then, technology has made surveilling students remotely easier than ever before, including a program called PowerSchool, which recently began offering parents around-the-clock online access to their children's grades and academic progress. Jessica Leahy is a New Hampshire parent and educator and author of a forthcoming book based off her article for The Atlantic, Why Parents Need to Let Their Children Fail. She recently wrote about why her family is choosing not to use the PowerSchool system to monitor their 14-year-old son. Jessica Leahy, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about PowerSchool. How does it work? What exactly are parents getting access to?
Well, PowerSchool is actually not that new. It's been around for a while. I've been using it in various schools. Actually, I think I've used it in 3 or 4 different schools. And the new aspect to it is the parent portal access point. And not all schools are choosing to use that. That's something that some of the schools where I've taught have decided not to open that up, that that's not a part of the program that they choose to embrace, whereas plenty of other schools have opened it up so that parents can have access to everything from attendance to homework, and I believe in some places also what they had for lunch.
So you're the parent of a 14-year-old boy. What led you and your family to make the decision not to use it?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been writing a book about sort of how to be a more autonomy-supportive parent. What I'm trying to do in my own family is help my kids know that they really are responsible for their own performance in school, their own work, their own chores, their own everything. And so the first way to do that is to make a pledge to talk to your kids rather than have the school hand over the keys to software that allows you to sort of look in behind their backs. The really important thing to keep in mind, though, is that for some families, this software has been fantastic, and parent involvement is really, really great for kids' performance in schools. I just didn't want our default position to be using software as a way to replace talking to our kids and trusting that our kids will talk to us.
Does your son have a history of ever lying about his grades, or has he ever misled you about his academic progress?
No, not that I know of.
Well, if he did, do you think it might be possible you'd think a little differently about the program or might use it in a different way?
Absolutely. I do understand some of the response that I got on, I believe in the comment section on the Atlantic article, was that, you know, I happen to have a kid that I can trust, but what if I had a kid that... or that I think I can trust. I'm touching wood right now. But if I didn't, would I think about it differently? And absolutely I would. I'm making a decision based on my own private, you know, family situation. And as I said, I'm not saying in the article that I think every single person should throw away their password and username to PowerSchool. I'm saying stop before you log in for the first time. Think about whether that's what you want to start with your kid, whether that's the communication you want to send about your trust in their ability to talk to you.
Well, and that's sort of what I was thinking when I read it, is that, you know, there's obviously nothing wrong with parents being included in their children's academic progress. And I think you'd probably be hard-pressed to find people that think they shouldn't be involved or should be less involved. So
absolutely.
So what makes PowerSchool potentially a negative influence or a positive one for families?
Well, and keep in mind also, PowerSchool is not the only program out there. There are plenty of other programs. One of the other ones is mentioned in the article. PowerSchool, as I mentioned, it's fantastic for teachers in particular. I use it all the time to, you know, track attendance and get all kinds of other information in the computer about the kids. That's not the issue. The issue for me is that the parents who are already quite involved with their kids' education are using it a lot, are using it many, many times a day. I talk to many teachers and administrators who, because they can actually see when parents have logged on, know for a fact that parents are logging in a couple times a day, which is where the title of the article came from. On the other hand, there are many, many parents who are not involved at all. So what I'm looking for here is, you know, to bring the pendulum back to the middle somewhere and say, you know, of course we want involvement. Of course you should be able to use software to be able to find out, you know, if your kid is sliding down the slope into towards an F. That's not what I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is that the envelope arrives with your PIN and your access code in the mail, and you automatically say, great, this is what I'm going to rely on. I don't really need to talk to my kid or talk to my kid's teachers. I can get everything from the portal.
So to find out what students are saying about this aspect of PowerSchool, you point out you only have to look as far as Twitter. So I checked it out. I pulled a couple tweets. Here's one. There's a student who said, "Oh, Lord, y'all, I've got at least 4 C's on PowerSchool," and that was followed by an unpleasant emoticon I don't need to describe here. There's another common complaint. Somebody says they really need to get PowerSchool working again because not knowing my grades is going to give me anxiety. So that made me wonder. It sounds like students have access to their grades through PowerSchool as well, and how does that affect them?
Well, they do, and it actually can work, it can work really, really well. Teachers can communicate with their students through PowerSchool. In fact, if you watch, I've been keeping a little column up in my tweet deck to look to see what's happening around the search term PowerSchool, and students seem to really rely on it. One thing that's very interesting about as a teacher is that grades can be really not a very good representation of where a student is at a given time. It's only the first couple weeks of school. If a student missed one homework assignment, they could very easily have a D or an F. And are we supposed to say to parents, well, look, you know, we're only in the second week of school or whatever week they're in. Your kid is an F student right now. You know, this article was put out there in order for parents and teachers to be able to say, do we really want to be quantifying kids by their day-to-day grades? Or do we want to sort of look at a bigger picture?
You know, we're talking about a generation of students who are often
talked about as having a problem with oversharing on social media or otherwise. So is it any surprise, given the fact that systems like this one could be taking away some of their privacy, that they're going to go out and put all their problems and all their personal issues out on the line?
Well, one of the things that drives me crazy in my classroom is when I hand something back to kids and they start immediately comparing their grades. And I've been seeing that happen even on Twitter, talking about the PowerSchool stuff. Kids will get on there and they'll say, oh, man, I just got a D on this. My mom is going to kill me. Social media is not private. And these kids who, you know, are posting about their grades on Twitter, I would love it if they would keep in mind that future employers, that other teachers, that their parents, that anyone who wants to look at their Twitter feed, if they're saying what their grades are and oversharing, I would love it if they thought carefully about that before they did so.
Jessica Leahy is a New Hampshire parent, educator, and writer. You can read her article for The Atlantic on PowerSchool at wordofmouthradio.org. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Affordable Care Act has gotten its fair share of media coverage since passing in December of 2009, but much of the discussion has focused on the massive law's more controversial aspects, the individual mandate and Medicaid expansion, for example. One under-discussed provision of the ACA is called the Sunshine Act, and it's designed to introduce more transparency into the substantial fees and gifts that doctors receive from pharmaceutical and medical device companies. Joining me to discuss the provision and what it will mean for doctors and companies is healthcare reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Peter Loftus. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Also with us is physician and author Danielle Ofri, who also writes about medicine and the doctor-patient connection for The New York Times. Danielle, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Peter, I want to start with you. Can you give our listeners just a brief overview of the Sunshine Act?
Sure. This is a provision, as you said, of the Affordable Care Act. It requires most pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies to report to the government detailed information about payments, gifts, and other transfers of value that they provide to physicians and teaching hospitals. The threshold is relatively low. It's any payment or transfer of value of $10 or more per doctor. And actually, payments lower than that would also be required to be reported if the total amount paid to a doctor in any given year is over $100.
Is it clear at this point how much money drug companies pay out to doctors annually?
I don't think there's a single number that we know yet that would encompass all that. But to give you an idea, Pfizer, which is one of the biggest drug companies by sales, they paid about $170 million in 2012 to physicians.
So, Peter, what exactly do companies need to do to comply with the Sunshine Act provision of the ACA?
Well, starting August 1st, they were required to have systems in place to track these payments. And so the sales rep who visited a doctor's office brought in pizza or sandwiches for the doctor's staff. You know, let's say it was $30 or $50 worth. The sales rep would have to keep track of that, and that would find its way back to the company's system for keeping track. And then they would have to have a system to be able to transmit that data to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Now, Danielle, you're a physician at Bellevue Hospital, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So a sandwich doesn't sound like a big deal, you know, individually. How often do you or other doctors that you know of accept, you know, the occasional free meal or more than that, speaking engagements, et cetera? Would you say that's a regular part of being a physician today?
Well, our hospital expressly forbids it. We do not allow any drug reps with anything at all in our clinic to avoid the conflict of interest. But I believe in private practice and many other hospitals, it is very common. And people don't think much about getting a sandwich. It's not a big deal. It helps you, or a textbook, or a pen, clipboard. But we all know that the drug companies wouldn't do it unless it worked. And that fact alone gives many of us a lot of discomfort. There must be a reason that they're giving us this. And so we'd like to not want to be bought and sold for a pen.
Do you think doctors have a good idea how much companies spend on them, or will the Sunshine Act be something of a wake-up call?
I think we know it's a lot. I mean, the omnipresence of drug reps in hospitals, it's impressive. They're everywhere. They always have things. And so we know it's a lot of money. But we each feel that, oh, well, I'm not influenced by that at all. But I think as a community, we certainly are.
So, Peter, what kind of penalties are companies facing if they fail to report information? And in your opinion, are those penalties stiff enough to ensure compliance?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the legislation itself spells out the penalties, and they range from $1,000 to $10,000 for each payment that's not reported as required under the law. So if it's reported late or inaccurately, they could be subject to that fine. And then there's a stiffer category of penalties for when a company knowingly fails to comply with this law, and that would be anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000 for each payment not reported. Now, the maximum total, I think, per year is about $1.15 million per company. And I wouldn't want to express my opinion on whether that's stiff, but I would point out that many of the bigger drug companies have paid settlements that are vastly higher to settle government investigations. For instance, GlaxoSmithKline, I think within the past year or two, they agreed to pay over $3 billion to settle some investigations by the Justice Department and some of the states into their sales and marketing practices. So when you look at those numbers, a million per year is not nearly as much. And these companies' annual sales are quite large. And so I think there is some debate about whether these penalties are stiff enough, but I think it remains to be seen whether they will get all these companies to comply.
Now, this next question, I'd like to hear from both of you. It's patient-related. I'm wondering if either of you expect patients will really be looking at this sort of information provided by the Sunshine Act, and more importantly, will it change their healthcare decisions? Peter, what do you think?
My sense is that currently not a lot of patients would actually go and look up this information and then have that affect their relationship with their doctors. But I do think that as this law takes effect, where it's becoming mandatory and it's all going to be reported on a single website next year by CMS, I would expect that there will be publicity associated with that. And so I think that could cause more people to look at these numbers.
Danielle, have patients of yours ever expressed an interest in this sort of information before?
I have not heard it specifically brought up, but I do think that many patients are concerned about, I don't want to say corruption, but unethical issues in medicine, that as we order tests, maybe we benefit financially and the cozy relationship of drug companies. So I think knowledge of the law will give patients more confidence in general in medicine. I think that's a good thing. I don't envision many going to look up specific doctors, but patients often do ask, if you order that test, are you making money on that? It's a common question, so I think there is a concern, and I think this act is helpful. Even if the amounts aren't punitive or so large for the companies, the idea that this should be out in the open is a positive one for doctors and for patients.
Danielle Ofri is a physician and author of several books. Her latest is What Doctors Feel. Danielle, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
And Peter Loftus writes about the pharmaceutical industry and healthcare for the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Philadelphia. Peter, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We have a link to more about the Sunshine Act provision of the Affordable Care Act at wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up after a short break, words and music from Vermont native and folk musician Sam Amidon. And later in the program, our surprisingly profound one-act radio drama, Diary of a Space Zucchini. Stay tuned for those and more stories told best by word of mouth in just a minute. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. And we're listening to the song, I Wish, I Wish. It's off Sam Amidon's new album, Bright Sunny South.
I wish, I wish my baby was born, sitting on her papa's knee.
The Vermont-born musician grew up in a musical family, touring New England and playing traditional folk songs. Now, Amidon tours the world playing his own music, though he's not exactly writing his own songs. Whether it's a traditional Irish folk tune or Mariah Carey, Amidon is known for creatively reshaping and reimagining the music of others. We caught up with Sam Amidon before his set at the Ottawa Folk Festival.
In terms of the way I make these albums, I mean, I love singing and I love songs, but I'm not that interested in songwriting. I grew up playing the fiddle, and I was much more interested in instrumental music. And, you know, when you play fiddle, whether you're playing classical music or folk music, you know, you're usually playing other people's melodies. So I was never that compelled by the need to invent something that you call, you know, your own song that you wrote or whatever. And so I'll take an old song. There's all, you know, all these different singers who song music I love. And if a song gets really stuck in there, in me, when I'm messing around on the guitar, often it'll come back out, you know, in a totally different context. And that's when I kind of call it my own.
I ain't ahead, and never will be, till the sweet apple grows on a sour apple tree. But still I hope a day will come that you and I shall meet as one.
You know, and I think the reason we still sing those folk songs is that combination of, like, the alienness of being placed into these other shoes, but at the same time, you know, finding something very close to us in there. But the fact is, you could find that anywhere. And I listen to all kinds of music, and whether you find that in a 19th century field recording or, you know, a recent Mariah Carey album, it doesn't matter. You know, if you find it, you find it.
I gotta shake you off, 'cause the loving ain't the same.
The Mariah Carey song is Shake It Off. It's on her album The Emancipation of Mimi from 2006, which is a deep interior journey in her soul, in the form of a pop album. And I was trying to do something like an interior journey for Bright Sunny South. And there's a quality of bluegrass and old-time music where there's a thing where you'll hear those songs which have those super happy melodies but really depressing lyrics, you know, and you hear it first and the guy's like, rah, 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 and you just think, oh, it sounds so happy. And then you realize the words are like, you know, and I shot him in it. And there was a similar phenomenon with that Mariah Carey song where the melody and the music on that track is this kind of jaunty dance number. But, you know, when I listened into the lyrics, there was just something very forlorn and lonesome and rueful and, you know, in the words. And so for me, I wanted to kind of just take the sentiment of the song and place it in a context that felt more, you know, closer to what the words, you know, what it was saying.
And you keep on playing games like you know I'm here to stay. I gotta shake you off, shake you off.
If I steal a folk song melody and I'm working on it, I'm sort of like the opposite of an ethnomusicologist. I usually have no idea where it came from beyond the version that I've listened to. I almost pretend that I wrote it. It's like a little trick that I do in my mind that I just like pretend that it's a song that I wrote, because that's the only way to feel that close to the lyrics, you know? And in fact, one of my favorite things about folk songs is the lack of knowledge about them, you know, the mystery and the randomness about them. You know, you'll hear a recording of a singer singing an old ballad, you know, and the story might just be totally surreal and not make any sense. And then, like, years later, you hear another version and you realize that the guy who you first heard, he just left out the third verse and he forgot it, you know, on that one recording. And it just rendered the entire thing completely bizarre. So I'd always sing that first version, you know, that's always the more compelling one to me.
That musical profile of Sam Amidon was produced by Zach Nugent. Amidon's latest album is called Bright Sunny South. You can find links to music and more at wordofmouthradio.org. If you think there are bad food deserts in cities across the United States, try finding some fresh produce in outer space. Astronauts living on the International Space Station don't go hungry, of course, but since it costs about $10,000 to send a single pound of food to the ISS, you can bet they don't see a lot of leafy greens. That cost is just one reason growing and harvesting fresh fruit in outer space is a crucial step in the future of manned space exploration. Jesse Hirsch is a staff writer for Modern Farmer, where you can find his article, Space Farming, the Final Frontier, and he joins us now to talk about the difficulty of putting produce in space. Jesse, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So up until now, what exactly have American astronauts been surviving on? We're talking Kraft mac and cheese and Tang, right?
Basically that, yeah. There's been some updates over the years. An article came out a couple years back about how they're trying to go a little fancier with their food, but at the same time, they're limited by constraints of space, meaning how much space they actually have on the space station and how much it costs to send everything up there. So they look for things that are densely caloric, things that will not cost that much and will last the astronauts a long time.
Do astronauts ever get the opportunity to have any fresh produce?
Yes. When there is a re-upping mission, as soon as the shuttle gets there, there's about a week or two worth of produce that they apparently tear through pretty quickly.
So last year, American astronaut Don Pettit conducted some small-scale farming experiments. Tell us a little bit about what he was doing.
This was just mostly a personal project for him. He brought up a zucchini plant, which was the star of the show, as well as a couple of other plants that he said were keeping his zucchini company, a sunflower plant and a broccoli plant. And he basically just grew them in a very low-tech way, raised them on using compost from the food that they were eating, and he would move the plants around from window to window, depending on where the space station was in relation to the sun. And he kept a blog using the voice of the zucchini called Diary of a Space Zucchini.
So on board this space station, astronauts experience, I think, 15 separate sunrises every 24 hours. So how does that unusual sun cycle and other things like zero gravity, for example, affect plant life? You know, how did they affect Don Pettit's plants?
Well, like I said, he was kind of winging it. He had not been fully trained on horticulture or what the plant needed. So I think that he just based it on instinct and was just moving it around based on whether the plants looked wilty or not. But the program that they are launching this year in December, they're not going to use the sun at all. They're actually going to use entirely LED lights.
So tell me a little bit about that program. You're talking about a plant experiment to grow lettuce.
To grow lettuce, yes. In December of this year, NASA is going to send up a program called Veggie, and it's the first time that they're ever going to be growing their own produce in space, potentially for the astronauts to eat. And so they're going to send up six romaine lettuce plants and grow them under LED lights. And the lettuce plants are very quick to grow, easy to harvest. You don't need much preparation after they're done growing, so they can just go directly to the astronauts.
You mentioned space being an issue on the space station. Obviously, there's not a lot of it. What are some of the other big challenges facing space farming that earthbound gardeners might not have to think about?
Well, there is also the fact that there are germs that NASA is very careful about not being consumed by the astronauts. These are things that typically are not too harmful. There's bacteria on our skin. There's bacteria everywhere here, but can have significantly more adverse effects up in space. Once they grow the first set of lettuce plants, they're going to be very cautious about whether or not they are going to be safe to be eaten.
You write that Russians are already allowed to eat space-grown vegetation. The NASA astronauts aren't going to be able to eat their lettuce right away. That must be a little bit of a burn.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a burn. I don't think anyone's too happy about that. But I also got the sense that in talking to the scientists and astronauts, that they thought, well, you know, we'd rather be safe than sorry. We feel like the Russian side of the station is being a little lax, but I don't know if that's just the fact that they're sad that they don't get to eat it themselves.
We tend to think of growing food in space as fulfilling an obvious physical need, but you write that plant life also serves an emotional purpose for astronauts. How so?
Well, it's just been proven that tending a plant every day, the kind of the soothing zen of it, feeling like there's something in your care, kind of like taking care of a pet, can have immense psychological benefits. It's something that called horticultural therapy that's been tested out at prisons like Rikers Island, and it also has been shown, because there have been plants that were grown in space before, just not edible ones or ones that were able to be consumed by astronauts. And when you look at Don Pettit last year, for instance, it made his experience quite a bit better. The fact that he was tending these plants every day, it boosted his mood.
Yeah. In fact, his zucchini becomes something of an honorary crewmate in the diary.
Yes, I think he became quite close to it. I asked him if he would have been able to eat the zucchini or the broccoli, and he said that there was absolutely no way. He was too emotionally invested.
That sounds like that might be a problem.
Yeah, a little bit.
Jesse, tell me about the possibility of space livestock. You know, is there any discussion on whether astronauts could raise small animals, you know, as a source of protein, or is something like that totally out of the question?
It's not totally out of the question. In fact, the Russians have done tests on quails for some time. They have not actually consumed any, but they've been sending eggs up for decades now. They've had a lot of problems when you actually hatch an egg in space. They have not been able to get them to full healthy adulthood thus far, but it is something that they have considered for quite some time. The key thing is, too, is that when you raise livestock in space, talk about something that requires a lot of resources and nutrients, and it takes up space. Like, you couldn't have a cow.
Right.
That'd be way too big. So it would have to be something along the lines of rabbit or quail, something small like that. And it's also been suggested that insects, they've done some testing in Mexico and Japan on whether insects would be a good protein source in space.
Jesse Hirsch is staff writer for Modern Farmer, a print quarterly and website about the people, places, and stories behind the food we eat. There's a link to his article about space farming at wordofmouthradio.org. Jesse, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Although NASA's Don Pettit has been back from his last mission aboard the ISS for over a year, his blog, Letters to Earth, remains one of the most fascinating and profound windows into the creative and emotional life of an astronaut. While in space, he penned and published Poetry, An Astronaut's Guide to Space Etiquette, and the aforementioned series, Diary of a Space Zucchini, which detailed life on the ISS from the unusual perspective of a self-conscious vegetable. We at Word of Mouth loved the latter so much, we decided it would make for some compelling radio. So, without further ado, may we present Diary of a Space Zucchini, adapted from Don Pettit's blog, Letters to Earth, and starring NHPR Sean Hurley as the courageous squash and narrator himself.
January 5th, 2012. I sprouted, thrust into this world without anyone consulting me. I am not one of the beautiful ones. I am the kind that makes little boys gag at the dinner table. I am utilitarian, hardy, vegetative matter that can survive under harsh conditions. I am zucchini, and I am in space. January 14. My gardener fusses with me several times a day. He checks that I have water, light, and with a hypodermic syringe, injects a tea-like concoction into the Ziploc bag which houses my roots. It's not very tasty, but I won't complain. On expeditions into the frontier, the food is often this way. February 3rd. I have learned that my gardener has a gardener too. Only his gardener does not water him, but speaks to him from a panel on the wall. His gardener must be very important. Everything stops whenever he calls.
3 minutes, LOS. All systems are go. Over.
March 10th. Sunflower's leaves are covered with brown spots. Both he and I are not feeling well. Broccoli seems to be doing okay. My gardener says it is something in the tea. March 11th. Broccoli is not doing well. His leaves are turning yellow. We are dying from some space malady. Gardener is frantically working to save us. I have heard that there is nothing to fear about the great compost. My only regret is that I will not be here on the frontier to help in this mission. March 23rd. We are recovering, growing greener every day. Our water diet was replaced with a new tea, one that is not salty. I have new leaves. I am no longer naked to the cosmos. June 12th. A great sadness has taken us all. Sunflower's sprout has died. He became weak, and his cotyledons could not emerge from the hull. We returned sprout to the compost from whence he came. I guess we were all made of recyclable materials. July 1st. Today, Gardner and his crew will depart in their seed pod. The replacement crew is ready to carry on in their place. He is wearing his spacesuit undergarments. Not too stylish, but functional. He gave all of us an extra long smell. He said that what will be is for the best. Gardner had tears in his eyes. He reached up and turned out the light. In the frontier, you should not be afraid of the dark.
That was NHPR's Sean Hurley reading from Diary of a Space Zucchini by astronaut Don Pettit, excerpted and adapted for radio by word of mouth. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more word of mouth next week on New Hampshire Public Radio.